Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, oh, oh. Wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.
And good morning, good morning, good morning. This is your host, Dr. Terry Mason. The show, The Doctor in the House. And it's heard every Sunday right here on WVON AM 1690. Every Sunday from 10 to 11. And I am grateful to be here. Today is the, we're also co-hosted by the University of Illinois, UI Health. Let me get it right, UI Health. And we're going to have a conversation about prostate cancer research. So I'm the, doctor, are you there?
I am here. Thank you. Good morning.
Good, good. Let me make sure that we properly introduce you and give you and allow you to say your name so people will be able to understand. So, and instead of me mangling it for you. So sure. What is your full name, doctor?
It's Ikenna Madueke.
I'm sorry?
Ikenna Madueke.
Ikenna?
Madueke. Madueke is the last name.
Help me, and that's Ikan, E like I can on the Ikan?
Yes, I-K-E-N-N-A, Ikenna.
Okay.
And the last name is Madueke, yeah. M-A-D-U-E-K-E.
M-A-D, uh-huh.
U-E?
U-E-K-E.
K-E.
U-A-K?
Madueke, correct.
Madueke. Well, listen, let's get right into your, first of all, you are doing prostate cancer research, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
All right. Tell us about the question that you, because whenever there's research, there's usually a question we're trying to get some answers for. So if I'm characterizing that quite correctly, what question is it that your research is trying to ask?
So I'm a uro-oncologist. So clinically,
okay.
I see, you know, the broad spectrum of a utilize oncology, whether that's breast cancer, prostate, kidney, you name it. But from a research focus, I deal specifically with prostate cancer. Now I've had a long interest in cancer biology, starting from a young age, with regards to why certain people might develop cancers that ultimately will cause mortality or death. As I got older and started, you know, focusing my career interests, I sort of narrowed those down to two cancers, and that was breast versus prostate. And so in medical school, I did a combined degree where I took another 4 years off to do my PhD in cancer biology, specifically in prostate cancer. And so, you know, at that point in time, I looked specifically at was called the WNT pathway, W-N-T. People might know it well in colorectal cancer. But I looked at how that affected prostate cancer biology. And then clinically, once I got into my practice And I think your audience might know this. If not, prostate cancer is the most, diagnosed malignancy and second leading cause of prostate of cancer-related mortality. And that incidence is twice as likely, about 2.1 times as likely, for men to die from that, either of African descent, so if they're Black or of African ancestry. And with that said, there was a keen interest in trying to understand the biology and those questions. Why is prostate cancer more prevalent in African descent men, and why are we more likely to die from it? So that's the overarching question. And so the research questions look into specifics of that, from an ancestral standpoint, from an exposure standpoint, and then from a biological standpoint.
Well, these are great questions, and I'm anxious to hear what you've begun to uncover in terms of answers to such questions, because as you may or may not know, I am a retired urologist myself, and had firsthand experience dealing with the population that you were talking about. I had a very large practice and lots of men with prostate cancer. And we've also talked on this show about breast cancer and other cancers as well. But let's go get into that. So you started with the question. So where did you begin to look for a potential group of answers?
Yeah, so, just I think it's well known, right, from epidemiology studies, the incidences and the disparities with regards to those numbers that I sort of alluded to already. So there's no work that needs to be done from that standpoint. We know that. We know Black men are more likely to be diagnosed, and we know they're more likely to die from the disease. So that background is out there. With regards to where we started asking specific questions, at University of Illinois Cancer Center, we have a high percentage of men of African descent or African American men that come here for their care. And so we see that in our numbers. So we know that our patients tend to be more aggressive on presentation. Now you can debate whether that's a problem with access to care. They present it a little bit later, but likely not, right? It's probably a combination of those things. We see young men here who have more advanced disease that you might not see in a different population. So we have access to those patients, and we've looked at our data, and our patients present with more aggressive disease. So again, that sort of corroborates what we already know from epidemiological data. Now, with regards to the specific questions.
Let's stop for a moment.
Sure.
We have to make sure that our audience, they're not scientists. Our audience are not scientists. Yeah. We have to talk to them in a different kind of language so that we'll make sure they understand exactly what you're talking about. So we have to be real clear about our terms. So I will help in that regard in making sure that we, because you've said a lot, and we want to make sure that people understand it. Now, the question your researchers was trying to ask is probably that very, very troublesome three-letter question, and that is why. Why is this the case? Not just that is the case, but why is that the case? And the question is it true for all men of color that this difference exists, or in just some?
So it will not be all, but in a significant number, yes. So the why, just very broadly, that why, again, it's probably multifactorial, right? There's no single bullet to answer that why. What we propose, and it's probably likely, again, is that it's a combination of different things. It's probably a combination of exposure, right? How do we get exposures? Things we eat, things that we might breathe in, be exposed to in the environment, so exposures. What we're born with, so genetics, right? When we talk about family history, why is that important? Well, your family history, some of that is passed down to you. So genetics. And then ancestry. So, what do we have ancestrally that's passed down from our ancestral origins? So from where most of the slaves came from, some form was Africa, right? What are those ancestral genes that are passed down that predispose us to getting prostate cancer? So those are three broad things. And then we can look at specifics and answer questions with those regards. And we can stop here, and then I can expound on each one of those three things with regards to what we've seen thus far and where we're going.
Sure, because, and then, and as we get down through the conversation, we want to talk about those things. Some things are not modifiable. I mean, you can't change
Correct.
Who you are.
Yes.
But, and so the other thing, there are some things that we've known or may know that are modifiable, like things we eat and things of that nature. So let's,
right.
first of all, talk about where, what groups of families, what groups from a epidemiologic, or that is looking at the numbers point of view, is it all black men? Is it darker black men? Is it lighter black men? Is it black men that come from certain parts of the world or have ancestry from certain part of the world? What have there been, what's jumped out thus far,
right.
if anything?
Yeah, so this is work in progress, right? And what we've done is take away self-reported race, right? So to your question of darker versus lighter men, I'm taking that out. And so now we're able to quantify a degree of what we call it, Africanness, if you will. You know, so it's objective data. And again, this is ongoing work. And we're able to, and hopefully in the next couple of years, we can actually use objective data with regards to percent of ancestry and look at risk from that standpoint. Now, whether or not they are darker or lighter, we'll get information down the street. But we're looking at objective data with regards to degree of, again, I'll use the word Africanness based on genetics. Okay, so that information is being worked on now. With regards to who's more likely, so a lot of work we've done is from West Africa. Do we have data from South Africa? Yes. How that translates to men in the Western world, the U.S. or the Caribbean, we're seeing those. We're going to get that data soon. Now, my suspicion is, again, most of the men here are probably from the west part of Africa. So we'll see similarities there with regards to ancestral risk that might be different from, say, South Africa or East Africa, where the slave trade was a different route. Again, these are projects in that are ongoing right now. We will say some of the preliminary data we've seen is similarities in regards to, you just call them, single nucleotide polymorphisms. Again, these are just markers, okay, where we can see ancestrally, have things changed, or are they similar? And there are markers that we have with men here in the U.S. that are similar to men, say, from, say, West Africa. There are unique differences from men in Africa that are not seen in men here. And there are unique differences between Caucasian men that are not seen in either group. So, again, these are all questions that we're looking at, and then we'll have a better answer hopefully next year is here. And then take that a step further, actually, and now ask what's actionable about these things that we're seeing, right? And so it's not a matter of just reporting, well, we see these differences in these genes, but how do these genes affect disease progression, disease initiation, and ultimately therapeutics as well? How does that predict how men will react once we treat them with certain drugs?
Well, the other question is, what role, if any, and then I know this is early in your collection of data, and if you are collecting data, if it's possible, on things people eat. I mean, there's some similarities and some differences in foods that are shared by the men in the populations that you have looked at. And I know you probably don't have anything definitive to say about that just yet, but are you looking at that? And do you think that, at least from a hypothetical point of view, does that matter?
100%. I think it will matter. Now, I can't speak to any strong degree of confidence. We're getting that data now. And so we have very detailed dietary intake forms from patients coming in. And so that's one part of exposure is what men take in. And I think there's a lot of work being done in this regard with regards to diet and how that might, change like the metabolic syndrome and things like, chronic inflammation from diet and things like that. So we're looking at that in very big detail. I just want to also mention in regards to exposure, it's just not things you ingest. So are you exposed to things like, say, heavy metals, right? Are you exposed to lead? Are you exposed to things in the water that you drink? All the things we're looking at as well, and we're collecting objective data on those exposures. And again, we're going to correlate that to the sort of disease that these patients will present with. And hopefully also take that a step further once we see certain things that are coming out all the time and actually test these to see that actually will have disease progress, you know, in a lab sort of fashion. So, yes, we're looking at all that data, and not just food, but other exposures in the environment.
Well, I mean, you think about food and you're talking about the geographic boundaries that you're looking at. That's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. And so, you know, right now we probably wouldn't have other data results for the next 5 years. But yes, it is a lot of work.
Well, I mean, but it's important work to do. But until you have enough information collected and obviously to statistically evaluated, to determine whether or not this means something or not. I'm just saying this is an amazing piece of work that needs to be done. And then to be looking at that in contrast to people who are not of African, well, I shouldn't say African descent, because all of us are from African descent one way or the other. but the question, well, that's true. More than us that will admit to. So we then need to understand, and I'm trying to get my listeners to understand the enormity of the process that you're going through, and which is why we can't come up with an answer next week.
No, definitely not. Definitely not a meaningful answer. I get this question a lot, right? A lot of my men come in and they get a diagnosis, and a lot of them ask the same question which you alluded to. Is why, right? Why? And again, you sort of give a clear cut answer, which is true, that it's probably multifactorial. Again, it's probably a combination of genetic risk, ancestral risk, exposure, whether that's diet or anything else. But we don't know the core why. And these are the questions we're trying to answer.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. And I'll be want to follow you so that when we get that answer, we can share it with that right away with our listeners right after it comes out of the journals. But the other issue that of what we know today, what is there anything that we know already today that are helping to guide more detailed questions in your research?
Sorry, more detailed with regards to?
Well, just trying to find what path. We don't know the path that's going to get to the answer, but we have some things that we say are risk or high. We used to always talk about risk factors, and those risk factors were gleaned after looking at many things about what people. I'm sorry.
I didn't say anything. I think someone else said something.
No. So I just wanted to let people know that this is a very, it's not easy to do. This work takes a lot of time and a lot of analysis. So what kinds of material information are you currently gathering? And if people come in, are there things that you're looking at in more detail? For example, first degree relatives that have prostate cancer. Right. Or, you know, like father, son, or brother, brother,
sure,
that
sure,
kind of thing.
Sure.
Are,
yes.
Are those the kinds of things that are helpful in your research?
We're collecting all of that. And not just from a research standpoint, but from a clinical standpoint with regards to, again, predicting prognosis and things like that. And so, yes, very detailed family history, not just of prostate cancer. We look at breast, we look at ovarian, right? We know that some of these familial syndromes might manifest in non-male family members. So a very detailed family history. We take, again, I mentioned that already, detailed dietary history. The dietary history is more on the research side, not just from the clinical side, okay? With regards to what we actually take, we bank blood, okay? From there, we get some of the genetic data that we use, again, to predict sort of ancestral risk and some of the other questions with regards to mutations. And then we follow, most of our men will get MRIs, so we have a very good map of the prostate, the kind of disease that's being harbored in the prostate. And then, you know, surgical history, and then they have sort of an oncological family history. So those are the big ones.
Yeah, and what about the role of, I mean, things like benign prostatic hypertrophy? I mean, just the size of the prostate, right. Those kinds of things. Are those also things that you're looking at?
Yeah, so we have that data, right? So we have prostate size. I think that plays a role with regards to density, like, so prostate-specific density. So I tell my guys, okay, so a lot of times, you know, men have friends and they talk and say, oh, well, my PSA was 4. And the guy says, well, my PSA was 6. And then maybe the guy with a PSA of 6 has a 200-gram prostate. Well, it's not the same disease, right, with a guy with a 30-gram prostate. And so we look at density from that standpoint. We try to make it clear to our men that if it is benign, so BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, that doesn't predispose you to prostate cancer, right? So we try to stress that point as well. So we have all that data, and we try to teach men, again, the difference between those two things.
Well, the question that I'm going to ask you to go, I'm going to go back to that, and that is a point you just made. And are you counseling men to let them, you're saying you're counseling men to let them know just because they have a larger prostate, it is not necessarily a beacon that says that you may have a higher risk of having prostate cancer?
Correct, 100%, yes. And we try to stress that very well. Correct.
That just because it's large doesn't mean you're more likely to have prostate cancer.
You get prostate cancer, exactly, yes.
And is the converse true? What about men with, I don't like to say smaller prostates, but does it work the other way too? In other words, is it, you see something different thus far with your research in men with a lesser size prostate?
Right, so I think that all ties into the PSA density, right? So, and we get this point across, you know, so if a man comes with a small prostate, let's say the PSA is 10. Okay, I have two men in my office, both with PSAs of 10. All right, one guy has a 30-gram prostate, the other guy has a 200-gram prostate. Now, I biopsy both those guys, and just from a pre-biopsy discussion, I might tell the guy with a 30-gram prostate, well, there's a higher chance that I will find something clinically significant in your prostate as opposed to the other guy, right? So it helps in counseling from a pre-biopsy standpoint. If they're both negative, they're both negative. And again, most of these men will have MRIs beforehand. So I sort of already know if there's any sort of clinically significant lesions based on the imaging going in. But yes, you know, PSA density is a predictor, right, of clinically significant prostate cancer. So we get that point across. Yes.
All right. And let's just really quick, because people always want to know symptoms. And I, as a retired urologist, I tell people there are no symptoms and I just want to know if you are finding that to be the case as well, that are directly referable to whether or not you have prostate cancer or not. You know, you can't say because I have this symptom or go ahead.
Yeah. It's quite, I see that quite often pre biopsy and post biopsy. Right. You know, some of my guys come in, elevated PSAs, how to end up in my clinic. And then we talk about the different reasons, the specificity of PSA, what's indicated, and if they're going down the route of a biopsy. And at that point, some men will say, well, I have no symptoms. This is just a test that my primary care doc ordered. Why do I need the biopsy? But ultimately, I think they do end up getting a biopsy if it's indicated. And then I have men who will get the biopsy, and it's positive, right? It comes back with some cancer. Let's call it Gleason 8 prostate cancer, right? So some sort of treatment is indicated, right, for high-risk prostate cancer. They get staged. dysphagia is negative for advanced disease or metastatic disease. So it's localized gleason 8 or grade group 4 prostate cancer. Then you talk about treatment options.
No, I was going to say, I just want to let our audience chime in if they have questions. We're having a great conversation about prostate cancer and prostate disease. So if you have questions, give us a call here at 773-591-1690. That's 773-591-1690. All right. So we want to let our callers have an opportunity to ask a question. Caller, you're on the air with your question. Go right ahead. Hello, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Oh, yes. I just had a, I talked to you before, Dr. Mason, but I just had a biopsy in April, and the 12 samples, and one came back with a G left base high grade prosthetic INTRAEPITHGPIN. I was wondering, is that cancerous, or should I have be concerned about it, or what? The other 11 were all benign.
All right, now you want to, for the doctor's benefit, could you re-say that first part you've spelled out, because I didn't get that, and I don't know if the guest got it either. Go ahead, say it again.
I think you said he has high grade pin in one of 12 cores.
He had high-grade PIN. Okay.
Yeah.
And, is that what you said, sir? H-I-G-H-P-I-N?
Grade PIN. I-N-T-R-A-P-E-P-I-T-H-E-L-I-A. H-G-P-I-N. H-G-P-I-N, yes.
Okay. Go ahead. Let our guest respond. Go right ahead, sir.
Doctor. Did you have an MRI of your prostate beforehand?
Yeah, I did have an MRI, but I've had like about three biopsies, and all of them came back benign. But this one here, which was done in April, I believe, it came back with this high grade.
Right, good pin. And what was your PSA level?
My PSA level, I've had quite a few blood tests, my doctor, and they all bounce around between 10 and 12.
Mm. And you have to know how big your prostate was. Did they mention that in like grams on the MRI?
No, he didn't, but he's always told me over at the university, he just said, you just have a very large prostate.
Right.
So let's take the question of size of prostate and... Let's take this issue of size of prostate. Will the size matter, small or large, Doctor?
Okay.
Yeah. So again, it doesn't matter from a standpoint of if it's BPH, right? If it's benign, that first word benign. So and again, that ties into a density, right? So how dense is that PSA that we're looking at, right? So. Again, if your PSA is bouncing between 10 and 12, first of all, if it bounces around, that tells me there's something inflammatory going on, right? Some sort of prostatitis. If it's 10 today, it's 7 tomorrow, it's 12 the next day, there's a little bit of a prostatitis going on. Usually, if it's going up in prostate cancer, it doesn't go back down. Okay, so that's the first part. Now, if you've had three biopsies, all negative, you've had an MRI, and the MRI doesn't show anything suspicious, I'd be less inclined to biopsy you again. Now, if you have high-grade PIN on your first biopsy, usually I would re-biopsy within about 6 months, okay, just to make sure that there's nothing there that we should be worried about. Again, with an MRI, to make sure I can target any specific places that might look suspicious.
Okay. Did we have another question from another caller?
Yeah, Dr. Mason.
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Oh, don't call me sir, doctor. I work for a living. A couple of questions for the doctor. And Dr. Mason, I want to thank you for your humanity to humanity. Here's the question. How do prostate cancer impact Africans and the motherland? That's the first question. Next question. Could the Tuskegee experiments that they did on black men, could it have contributed to our prostrate numbers? Next question.
Wait a minute. You have a whole. Okay. Let's start with these two. Go right ahead and give the doctor a chance to answer. Go ahead.
All right. So the first question, how is prostate cancer in the motherland? We have worse disease. And now whether that disease is worse from, again, the genetics on ground or whether it's worse from the exposure on ground, we're looking into that now. What I will say is one impact that is definitely a reason is lack of screening, right? So here we still screen. I know there was a little bit of controversy with regards to screening. Again, that's checking the PSA blood levels. So on the continent, there's no screening. There's no national guidelines for screening. So most men don't screen. And so the disease we see there is pre-PSA era, right? So we still see a lot of men that are coming with symptomatic prostate cancer, right? So disease in the bone, disease in the spine, they can't walk because they're paralyzed. We see a lot of that. That's because people are not being screened. And so we know that that's a contributing factor. Now, how genetics and exposure plays a role as well, we're looking at that now. But the disease is worse, definitely because, again, it's a pre-screening place. The second question, the Tuskegee study. Now, obviously, I was looking at something entirely different from cancer, but I think that does play a role with regards to how a lot of diseases are progressing. Now, we can get enrollment of African-American men or African descent men from a standpoint of mistrust of the system, right? So there's still a lot of trials ongoing, clinical trials for drugs, clinical trials for things that will improve.
That's why she was crying because...
Because he was leaving? Is that why his name she was crying?
I don't know, Miss I, but...
All right, now we can only have one person talk at a time, sir. So let's have one person talk at a time. Let the doctor finish the other question, answer that question, then we'll go to the next caller. Go ahead and finish your point, doctor.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and we need to have only the callers on the phone, please. So we ask.
Hello?
Hello.
Sorry, I think I was talking out of that loss. Was that lost for a second there?
We're still here. Go right ahead.
Did you hear my response? Sorry.
I don't know that he did. You want to say it again to him? Because I think he's off the phone.
Oh, he's off the phone? Okay. No, essentially I was saying that in on the continent, we do have worse disease, and that's probably from a combination of lack of screening. There are no screening guidelines, so no PSA screening. So essentially it's a pre-PSA era where a lot of men are presenting with advanced symptomatic prostate cancer. So bone disease, cord compression, men are paralyzed. We see a lot of that on the continent, again, probably from lack of screening. Now, whether there's a different exposure or a different genetics in play as well, we're looking at that work now, but definitely disease is worse in part due to lack of screening. In regards to the second question about the Tuskegee study, I don't think that plays a role directly with regards to prostate cancer incidence, but it plays a role with regards to a mistrust of the system, right, based on that study. And so if you look at the trials, where ongoing trials now for drugs for prostate cancer, for any sort of other treatment, predictors of prostate cancer. A lot of African-American men or African descent men are not enrolled in these trials, in part due to a mistrust, again, of the system. And so that plays a role indirectly with regards to those numbers being bad, not directly, but indirectly from a mistrust of the system.
Well, I think those are great points, and I really appreciate you making those points. Do we have any other callers waiting?
This is Mansong Kulubali.
Yes, sir, Brother Kulubali. How you doing?
Hey, man, I'm still standing. I want to ask the the doctor that you have there, what part of Africa is he from?
Nigeria.
Igbo?
Correct.
Kedu?
Oh, <them.
laughs> Kene Chukwu for you and your skill.
All right, now, come on.
Brother.
We're trying to get these questions in. Now, we don't need to show your language prowess out.
No. That ain't what it is, brother. It's just, you know, respect for his language.
Thank
but
you,
I wanted to just say this. I'm a prostate cancer survivor myself, and I feel that there's a dark side to that whole medical thing with prostate cancer or cancer, period. There's a brother who's a health researcher, and he has an herbal products company. His name is Heru Ofori Atta. If you go to his website, herbalresults.net, he has an ebook entitled The Successful Eradication of Cancer Using Intracellular Parasite Theory. He feels, as well as many others who do that research, that the medical establishment is barking up the wrong tree with cancer. It's not a mutagenic thing. It's caused by intracellular parasites feeding on inflammation. And so I would urge people in the listening audience to go to that website, herbalresults.net, and you'll get solutions, non-toxic solutions, non-invasive solutions to diabetes, cancer, high blood pressure, and a lot of those other ailments that we're afflicted with. One thing that I remember, doctors, that the nurse practitioner was rushing me into some surgical procedures. I took a whole year, you know, before I succumbed to that. And when they do the biopsies, that's an insult to that organ, and it creates more inflammation, which the parasitic parasites feed on. So there's a whole different kind of approach and protocol to cancer, diabetes, and all these other things. Go to herbalresults.net. And with that said, I'm done. Asante Sana.
Thank you so much, brother. Always, always insightful things to discuss. And I'll let our guests go ahead and respond. Go ahead, sir. Doctor.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think definitely there is a role for inflammation and cancer, and a growing role for that in prostate cancer specifically. So I'm not familiar with this website, but if it's targeting some sort of anti-inflammation, I would not be surprised if there is a benefit there with regards to prostate cancer initiation or slowing of progression. So I would agree with that, with inflammation being a harbinger of disease progression.
Well, I would also add to the inflammation, because I understand, you know, much of what we have has an inflammatory problem. Most of the, even the vascular diseases, so-called things like coronary artery disease or things that create strokes, heart attacks, these are all inflammations, and a lot of these are foodborne. You don't need to look anything for anything spooky or anything different. It's from the foods that, much of it is from the foods that we're eating.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we'll have another, I have a whole other show talking about that. But were there any other callers? Is there another caller? I'm sorry? All right, good. So, Dr. Let's just apart for a moment at the role that you've seen in inflammation, especially when you look at prostate biopsy, sometimes you can see some things. Do you have anything you'd like to comment in that regard?
So I don't study inflammation per se, specifically.
Okay.
So I'm not very well versed in that regard. There is growing data, a body of data in the community that sees or seems to suggest that a chronic inflammatory state is associated again with higher grade disease and disease progression. But it's just not my area of interest specifically, but that's a growing body in the community.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, that's helpful to get that information. Do we have any more questions for our guests? Any questions for our guests? We'll take those now.
Yes, sir. I want to ask the doctor, is he familiar with a prostate cancer procedure called TULSA-PRO, T-U-L-S-A-PRO? It's an app outpatient procedure that destroys cancer tissue from inside the prostate with ultrasound heat.
Doctor?
Yeah, so so it's probably referring to like a HIFU for prostate cancer. What I will say is prostate cancer tends to be multifocal. What do you mean by that? It usually not just in one place. You can have maybe a lesion that you see very well on one side on, say, MRI, but you might have a smaller one on the opposite side. So focal therapy, okay? So disease where you can put, you know, ultrasound probe and use ultrasound to ablate a lesion. The data, the data is still out there. The jury is still out there in regards to how well that will treat disease that needs to be treated. Okay, what do I mean by that? You can have a man with grade group 1, what we call Gleason 6 disease, right? And PSA is under 10. Most of these men now will undergo what we call active surveillance, right? That's where you sort of just kind of watch. We know that this is not a disease that leaves the prostate, doesn't cause a problem. Most men will not die from this type of disease. So that's the guy that you watch. Now, if that guy says, I want treatment, yes, I'm comfortable, you know, saying, well, get HIFU or this focal ablation to this particular place. But that's a man that probably shouldn't be treated in the first place.
For a man, what that focal ablation is. Talk about what focal ablation is. That's a term that I'm sure most of my listeners don't know what that means.
Right.
Go ahead.
So that's where you use some sort of energy. In this case, let's say HIFU ultrasound. So high frequency ultrasound, and you're destroying tissue that you can see with some sort of imaging device. And that's all that means. It means you're destroying tissue in one area, so it's focal. It's not you're not treating the entire prostate per se. Okay. Now, if you have, you know, that grade group 4 or 5, you know, Gleason 8, 9, or 10 disease, that should be treated as a whole gland. Okay. That HIFU is an undertreatment. I will not recommend that. And so it's, again, it's a nuanced conversation, but the jury is still out on those treatments for disease that should be treated. And so I'd be wary or just be very careful about signing up for those if you have disease that should be treated. Again, grade group 1, Gleason 6, 1 quarter of Gleason 7, that maybe can be washed if you use HIFU, maybe not a big deal. But for more aggressive disease, I'd be worried about signing up for that.
Well, thank you for that answer. Carl, did that answer your question? He must be gone. Do we have another caller? Caller, you're on the air with your question. Okay. Well, that, you know, that was great to hear about HIFU. I haven't heard about HIFU in a long time. I'm a retired urologist, and HIFU was just...
Oh, yeah, it's out there. It's out there.
Yeah, and we use the term HIFU, and that's just the way of not using the acronym, which is HIFU. That's what we're talking about. Imagine using, and Doc, why don't you go ahead and explain it one more time? I never did it when I was in practice. It just come out when I was just about ready to retire. You want to go ahead and explain the theory, at least, behind how it's supposed to work and who are the candidates for it?
So then this is probably more just of my opinion with regards to HIFU. Again, just based on disease process, okay? Now, I don't offer HIFU. I don't do it. I did it in my fellowship training. And a lot of people don't offer HIFU yet, so there's a few places that offer HIFU. And I think with regards to who's the ideal candidate for it, I think, again, the jury is still out. Now, all it is it's high-frequency ultrasound, okay, that you can target to a particular place that you can visualize radiologically, okay? And so obviously you need a targetable lesion. So a lot of times you have an MRI already, you know the area that you have this lesion that you want to target. You put your probe, there's a mapping that goes on, and you're able to direct the frequency ultrasound to that particular lesion. And using that force from the ultrasound, there's no cuts in there. It's not like radiation. The collateral scatter is theoretically less. You're able to destroy that tissue using that ultrasound force, if you will. Okay. But again, with prostate cancer, again, being a multifactorial disease, okay, you have to be careful about doing focal, one place, destroying one place for a disease that can creep up or pop up anywhere else. You don't burn bridges, okay, by you doing HIFU. And so you can get it, and then you can get treated again. I mean, assuming you don't progress to metastatic disease. But for men who I'll be comfortable referring to a HIFU place or undergoing HIFU will be men who probably don't need to be treated in the first place, right? So men with grade group 1 disease, Gleason 6, or men with low volume, Gleason 7, who still fall under that low risk or favorable intermediate prostate cancer.
And what about age?
Whether you want to use it for men who are not surgical candidates, is that what you're referring to?
Well, either not surgical candidates or is there such a thing as being too young, such a thing as being too old?
Yeah, so and maybe that's just because I'm talking just from an oncology standpoint. If you're going to be treating cancer, then treat the cancer, right? And for cancer that needs to be treated, so again, your favorable, unfavorable intermediates and higher, I would not recommend that at any age, right? They need to be treated. If you're old, you're too old to undergo surgery, then get what's clinically proven with either radiation and ADT or something along those lines. Definitely if you're young, you want to be more on the aggressive part. I know to miss the window of cure. And so, yes, I wouldn't recommend that for a young patient who should be treated and not risk a chance of metastatic disease.
Before we get off the air, I want to make sure that we give our listeners an opportunity to those that have not been able to make a question. And I thank everyone that's had a question. These are all good questions. And, you know, I always want to make sure that we put out is what we in terms of what we may know and then what we don't know, because I don't want to mislead anybody, because there's a lot of people talking about a lot of different things, and some of that stuff has not really been appropriately proven. So I think the only thing we can say sometimes is yes, we've heard of it. I've not heard and I'm not seeing it proven to do this or that. And so just because we may not say, yes, you should do this, and no, you shouldn't do that. That's why.
Right.
Doctor, if people want to get in touch with you
and just
to be evaluated, what number of people can you use?
Also, Dr. Mason, just to
Hello?
That point that you just mentioned. Dr. Mason?
Yes, I'm here. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just to that point of things that we might or might not know, just to your audience as well, one of the things we're looking at UI Cancer Center is, are you familiar with licorice roots?
Say that again, please.
Are you familiar with licorice root?
Licorice, yes.
Yeah. So the active component of licorice
root, I'm more familiar with the candy, but the licorice root, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the root has an active component. It's called glycyrrhizin. And it's been shown to have some anti-cancer effects on like other solid tumors. And so one of the things we're looking at here to study, pioneered by one of our medical oncologists, Dr. Natalie Raisin. But we're seeing that there's an effect in prostate cancer, localized prostate cancer, in men who have opted to undergo surgical treatment for that. And so we have these men take the active component glycyrrhizin of licorice root, several doses within about 4 to 6 weeks before treatment to see if there's any benefits to that. This is a relatively new study, about a couple of months in, so we don't have any preliminary data yet. But that's, again, to your point of, you know, there might be some things out there that we just don't know, that people might hear about, we need to look at in a sort of randomized fashion to know if there's any benefit as well. So that's something we have, the licorice roots, and hopefully in the next 2 or 3 years, we'll see if there's any benefit to that. And obviously, man can get licorice, you know, in the stores if there is a proven benefit there.
And we'll be to make sure to bring that information to you right here on WVON on the Doctor in the House as soon as we have it, just so we know what we're saying. When we talk about something proven, usually what that means, there's a study, which is what the doctor is talking about. And to find out if something really works, you have to have the study. You have to figure out what the requirement's going to be. And what you do is, you're looking at something in prostate cancer or whatever. What you've got to do is you've got to identify the drug. You've got to identify how it's going to be used in each patient. You have to have a way to define what the disease was before you started, during the treatment, and after you started, and then a way to prove by biopsy or whatever that there's been something positive or not that has happened. So, and you do that to two groups of men and then see which ones do better, the ones that had it versus the ones that didn't. So that, and you don't, and the guys don't know which ones are getting which in order to make, and we'll talk about what a trial is in far more detail at another time. But just because a person has something and that worked for them does not necessarily will mean it will or will not work for you. So when we talk about studies, we're talking about a process that has been tried for years and years and years on how we come up with information that something is helpful or not. Doctor, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that was perfectly stated. And hopefully, again, we'll have some information for you in the next couple of years here with regards to not only the follicular study, but with regards to some of that ancestral work that we're doing as well.
Well, that's really, really so important because there's so much going on and there's so much opportunity. And I'm down to our, I think, the last couple minutes. Do we have a last caller that we can get real quick?
Yeah, doctor. What?
Yeah. Go ahead, sir.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, sir, because we're running out of time, but go ahead.
Okay, yes, doctor. I got prostate cancer. I had radiation. Now I got ED. Can you have normal relations after radiation treatment?
Okay, Doc, you want to take a stab at that first? I think because that'll be our last question for today because we're going to be out of time. Go right ahead, sir, as best we can understand.
I'm not sure if it's my end, but I really didn't hear anything of the question.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I could bear. Sir, could you repeat your question because I barely heard it. Okay, any other callers?
All I heard was ED, but that was it.
Yeah, and I think it was ED related to a treatment, but we have no way of understanding what that was. And maybe on another show, we'll talk about prostate cancer and some of the treatments and some of the issues that happen after treatment, whether it be with surgery, radiation, things of that nature, because people should be aware of these potentials. Yes. And all radiation ain't the same, you know?
Right.
It's not the same. Yeah. Did you want to make a comment as we get ready to go down to our last minute or so, sir? And remind people where you are. And how
definitely. So we're at the University of Illinois Cancer Center. And you can find us online at cancer.uillinois.edu. That's cancer.uillinois.edu. And you can call our cancer center at 312-413-5598. If you need a urologist, they can refer you my way or any of my partners. And if you're interested in clinical trials, any of those questions, that's all on the website.
Why don't you put that number out again twice and say it slower?
Sure. It's 312-413-5598.
And
the website is cancer. Dot U Illinois. So cancer.uillinois.edu.
And what's the phone number for the phone number and the address? We have the phone number. What's the address?
Sure. 818 South Walcott Avenue, Chicago, Illinois. That zip code is 60612.
Well, yeah, we'll have to have you back on again. I mean, we're going to have, because I had a lot of questions from them for prostate cancer. And you're doing other kinds of things. So I'd love to begin to bring you on and some other folks that you may or may not know. And thank you for the work that you're doing at the University of Illinois, because we've got to get answers, and we've got to get answers in the one that is consistent with good scientific methodology. So we know whether or not it's working or not. But this won't be my last time, sir. This will not be our last time. I can guarantee it, because I think it's a great topic. I think the questions were absolutely great. And I want also to talk about, you know, there are some men at large prostates, some don't. And we need to think about what that means, if it means anything, and whether or not that foretells of anything going forward, those that have very large glands, because I've seen them in practice in both very large and very small glands. But any last thing you want to give out just before we shut it down for today?
No, I think, again, just thank you for having me on. I think prostate cancer, unfortunately, is very prevalent in our community. We have to do a better job of educating and getting information out to our men. Screening is very important. I know there was some controversy a few years ago in regards to screening, but screening saves lives. That is not debatable anymore. Hopefully, you know, the work we're doing here and in other places will continue to make an impact with regards to decreasing the disparity we're seeing with how prostate cancer affects Black men.
All right. Well, I think my engineer is going to be telling me it's time to go. We always run out of time.
Thanks to all your callers as well for calling in and listening.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank all the callers. Thank you for all of your questions, and all of them help us sharpen our knowledge about the different things that we talk about on this show. And I'm always glad and blessed to be a servant, to be doing this now. This is over 31 years I've been doing this show. So I want to thank Melody Spann. Yeah, I want to thank Melody Spann Cooper for being so supportive. I want to thank all of you for all the years that we've been listening to the show. And of course, that next voice you're going to hear is Miss Pam Morris-Walton, who's coming to make a joyful noise over the radio. And until next week, at the same time and station, may God continue to bless each and every one of you with continued health and strength as I leave you now in peace.
The Talk of Chicago is 1690 WVON, Sherwin, Chicago.